Hello and welcome to this session, which is called What is an Author Now? Futures of Scholarly Communications and Academic Publishing. I'm Jane Hickler, I'm an academic here at the LSE. We've got a really interesting lineup of speakers, and what I'm going to ask them to do is to just give us kind of a couple of minutes, an initial kind of thought or position on this question. From all of the panel members, and then really this is going to be a discussion, so then it's going to be opening up the floor to you guys to see what questions you'd like to ask, what comments, provocations you'd like to put to the panel. There were meant to be some roving mics, but we haven't got them. So if you can just make sure you speak very clearly when you ask your question, and maybe tell us who you are. And I'll collect a few questions together and then we'll see which of the panellists want to pitch in. But as I say, we're going to start by hearing just a very short kind of piece from each of the panel members, and we're going to start with Christian Fuchs, who is a professor of social media research at the University of Westminster, and he's also an editor of an open access online journal called CCC.
Yes, so CCC stands for Communication, Capitalism and Critique. We are a journal for the Marxist study of communication on the content level, but we also are critical of the capitalist publishing industry. So what is capitalism all about? According to Marx, capitalism means that there's some capital that is being invested, then you produce a new commodity that is produced by labor power that is being exploited by capitalists, and this commodity is sold, capital is produced, and that is being reinvested. So, and of course, the corporate publishing industry has come under criticism for its high profit rates, and the issue is that a lot of public money flows from universities, publicly funded, the public funded academic systems, into the privately owned publishing houses. And what is being sold as a commodity here is our knowledge that is published in the format of books, articles, and so on, and is then sold back to us and to our libraries. So, who is being exploited here by the corporate publishing houses? Are the publishing workers on the one hand? There are of course stories about precarious work there, and the free unpaid labor of the academics. Yeah, and there are high profit rates that result from this. So, for example, profit rate 2012 of Taylor and Francis was about 25%, which is like for an industry very high, really. And that's not an exception. There are a lot of examples to this. Now, people talk a lot about open access. So is this an answer to it? But one must distinguish between different kinds of open access. And there's a lot of talk about the so-called gold open access model, which is partly the idea that you just reinvent a new business model, yeah, and turn again publishing into a profitable business. And there are, I mean, things like the Finch Report, yeah, or there are reports by the European Commission, or there's a network of 50 publishing organizations who all advance the idea of, or these 50 publishers, they speak of sustainable open access, and what they mean by sustainable is making profits out of open access. And they don't have the idea that maybe academic knowledge is something that should be independent of the capital form and the commodity form as such. So the idea of gold open access comes along with the idea of article processing charges. So the authors pay for having the articles published by open access publishing houses, and it's a kind of weird business model. So it's for profit, it's capitalist. One must say that publishing houses like Sage, Taylor and Francis, Springer and so on love it. They develop their own models like Sage Open and so on. But what does this mean? And I think of this as a kind of analogy. So this kind of gold open access, where you pay also processing charges, it's a little bit like you go into a restaurant, but you pay for getting into the restaurant, and then you are the cook cooking there for other people. So you are the cook and the customer at the same time. An absurd thing, or it's a little bit like a theater. Yeah, you go into the theater for watching a piece, but then you are the actor at the same time. Yeah, and then there's the theater company or the restaurant making money for it. But there's just people could do this without the company. So there's an unnecessary third person in there, and the kind of idea of open access publishing that I have is a communist publishing model that is directed against any form of labor exploitation and the commodity form as such. I think any commodity form is harmful. Yeah, and the problem is that also in the also processing charges model, there is exploitation. So still there are publishing workers who are being exploited. The authors are being exploited, and what is being exploited is the labor time of these people. And it does not make a big difference if you then pay an author processing charge of £100, as in the case of Sage Open, or if it's 500 and so on, because always it's unpaid labor time, and always it's the principle that there is the commodity logic, and that you must pay that someone must pay for something, and that there is a commodity, and wherever there is a commodity, someone must produce this commodity, and producing this commodity then means being exploited. And my idea is a non-corporate open access publishing model. I call it the diamond model of open access publishing. Diamond just because diamond is worth more than gold, and this means not-for-profit, non-commercial publishing that is done online, and there is no commodity involved there. And actually, this model, this diamond open access model, the majority of open access journals that exist already do it like this. So if you look at statistics in the directory of open access journals, then it's more than 70% of all journals that function this way. So the idea that you make a business out of open access is really something very alien for those people who are inside of open access, because they do it not as a business. And so I think this, talking about gold open access does not help, because it neglects political economy. It does not tell us is there exploitation, is there something sold as a commodity, and so on. So I think we should distinguish between this non-profit diamond open access model and then things like Sage Open. That's what I would call corporate open access. Yeah? So there is still labor exploitation there, and there's a commodity form there. But that's not enough, because then there are advantages of the non-profit model, because there's no exploitation involved. Knowledge gets available. You don't have to pay author processing charges, because author processing charges are also a form of exclusion. Yeah? Not everyone can pay them. Rich institutions like the LSE, well, they will give the money to their scholars. What about universities in developing countries? Commodity form always means that there will necessarily be exploitation and some form of exclusion. You don't have this in the non-profit open access model. But there must be some changes at the policy level also. So non-profit, non-commercial open access publishing needs some kind of financial support. So I think we need policy changes. On the one hand, we need public funding for non-profit diamond open access. We need policies that make it mandatory for research evaluation. For example, that non-corporate open access publishing plays a special role there. Promotion policies that when you publish in such journals, that this is especially good for your promotion. Also, when there's research funding and you receive some taxpayers' money, then it should be ensured that all outputs are only published in non-profit open access journals. Also,
well, site. Minutes is getting
Yeah. One sentence. Also, signed citations index, again, don't controlled by a capitalist company. EC Thompson should be substituted by something different, where the non-corporate open access journals are being indexed. So I think what we need is a communist revolution against the capitalist publishing system. As you know, sociologists like Robert Merton say that communism is at the heart of academics, because we want people to have access to our knowledge. We want to share it. We don't want, as academics, we don't want to limit the access to this knowledge, but also the idea of someone deriving private profits out of something that should be public as such, that's also alien to the academic system as such. So I think a communist publishing system is possible, but for this we have to struggle against, well, capitalist publishing companies like Sage, Routledge, Springer, and so on, who are our enemies and who should be destroyed.
Now, you're going to have to hold on to your questions just for a little bit.
Really?
But that's a really good start, I think. We're now going to hear from Gary Hall, who is director of a brilliantly known Centre for Disruptive Media at Coventry University. He also co-founded Culture Machine, which was a pioneer of open access in the humanities in 1999.
Anyway, okay. Thanks for I'm not really sure what I can add to that. That's just about covered everything and come up with a plan as well. I'm going to try and push open access, because I've been talking about this for a while, so I'm going to try and push and think about some of the things that open access doesn't think about, to kind of push that a little bit. And I suppose one way to think about what I'm working on at the minute or thinking about is, if some people are calling for a post-crash economics, which is a radical rethinking of the field of economics, it's going to challenge some of its own foundational assumptions, particularly in the light of the most recent crisis of capitalism, then I'm arguing that we need a post-crash critical theory too. So that would be a post-crash critical theory that doesn't just call on us to think differently, as we traditionally do in theories, or even, as one call was for today, for us to check our privilege. We can talk about what some of the problems might be around that. But that calls on us to change radically our own scholarly practices, in the sense of performatively inventing new economic and legal and political models for the creation and publication and circulation of theory. And why I'm saying that is, you know, there's some people that are saying that cultural forms like music and TV and cinema haven't really caught up with the change in political mood post 2008. You know, they're still being very dominated by certain careerist commercial imperatives, hostility towards the new, a social stratification of access. Usually in music, it's Mumford & Sons that get the blame for this. We'll see all the reports about acting being full of people who went to public school, usually Eton. But what I'm seeing is, you know, theory, those kind of criticisms also apply to some of the cultural forms that are associated with the production and publication and distribution of academic research. And this is a particular issue for that broad range of discourses in the humanities that we place under the heading of theory. I'll try and mention Foucault here. Foucault's influence on theory being one of his main intellectual legacies. So theory, as we know, is committed to challenging and changing our ways of being and doing in the world. And it's important precisely because it helps us to denaturalise and destabilise institutional and disciplinary formations, including those associated with theory itself. Yet if, as Bernard Stiegler insists in Technics and Time, if Western philosophy has forgotten that its origins lie with techniques, if it's repressed techniques as an object of thought, then many theorists, including Stiegler himself, ironically enough, have forgotten and repressed the media technologies by which their own work is not only produced and published and distributed, but also commodified, as we've heard, privatised, not to mention controlled, homogenised and standardised by for-profit companies operating as part of the cultural industries. Now, that kind of complacency on theorists' part is often noticeable when academic research is made available via those transnational corporations that are associated with disruptive digital technologies, thinking of social and mobile media, e-books, search engines and the cloud, so Amazon, Apple, Google, Twitter, etc., and the way that those kind of neoliberal technologies of the self encourage us to be highly visible entrepreneurs of ourselves and our subjectivities, to take responsibility on ourselves for managing and branding and promoting and marketing our work and ideas. And yes, I'm supposed to have a charismatic authorial personality now as well and get it out there. However, I don't want to just say it's to do with the new technologies. For me, this kind of forgetfulness on our part is no more evident than the way theory continues to be dominated by the print-on-paper codex, book and journal article, together with all the core humanities, concepts and values that have been inherited with them. So that includes things like the individualised author, the proprietorial subject, intellectual property and copyright, but it also includes things like the signature, the proper noun or name, originality, fixity, even the human we can add in. So, you know, one of the talks this morning was about the ref and the impact agenda and the way that's constituting our subjectivities. But it's not like the previous way of acting in the university. It's not like that didn't construct our subjectivities either. I mean, that was still, you know, a subjectification. So, for example, one example we can take is Rosie Bridotti's recent book, The Posthuman. And what she's proposing in that book, just to give you an example of this, is a criteria for a new post-human ethics that's capable of generating the conditions for renewed political and ethical agency in the Anthropocene era. So she emphasises non-profit, emphasis on the collective, experimenting with and actualising potential or virtual options, and a new link between theory and practice. And she, at the same time, she emphasises a new role for the university. The key words for here are open source, open governments, open data and open science. However, she kind of undercuts all that. You see that by the fact that Bridotti's not actually published her book on a non-profit basis at all. She's published it with Polity Press, who, although independent, distribute that book, The Posthuman, through Wiley, and Wiley, one of the big four profit-maximising publishing mega-corporations, along with Reed, Elsevier, Springer, Taylor and Francis and Foreman. You didn't get mentioned there. You're doing all right so far. Nor has she made it available for others for sharing and reuse on an open access or open source basis. Well, the post-human very much functions to sustain the sense of Bridotti as an identifiable, unified, individualistic human whose subjectivity is static and stable enough for her to be able to sign a name on a contract, giving her the legal right to assert identity as the author of the work, and to claim this original, fixed and final version of the text as her intellectual property. So, having said all that, my concern is not to develop a moralistic critique of these kind of radical thinkers for failing to make their knowledge and research available on a Creative Commons or open access basis. Neither of those stances are necessarily anti-commercial or anti-capitalist either, although there's potential. What I'm interested in is where that publishing online raises the stakes for theory even higher than that. I kind of realise, and one of the things I'm working through, is that, you know, this lack of a legal or economic or political, what you might think of, following Foucault's anti-humanist alternatives to publishing either on a copyright or rights reserved or open access and Creative Commons basis that are professionally recognised, you know, there's no easy way of responding to that or solving that problem. Nevertheless, I guess what I'm interested in and what some of us are working on at the moment is how, as theorists, we can actually operate differently with regard to our own work and business and role and practices, the point where we begin to confront and take on and think through, rather than take for granted or repress or ignore, some of the implications of our theory, some of our ideas of the human and the author and subjectivity and the book, for how we live and work and act as thinkers. So in short, what I'm interested in is theory that's not just trying to produce a new way of thinking about the world, as theories traditionally try to come up with, but, you know, new ways of us actually being in the world as theorists.
Thank you.
That's a bit longer.
Averaging 7 minutes, which I will accept. We're now going to hear from Ziad Mara, who is the Global Publishing Director of Sage, and he's also worked on issues around open access and actually contributed a chapter to the British Academy's volume on debating open access.
Thanks. I'm conscious of the fact that I could be engaging with Sage and publishing as a specific topic. What I've sort of come prepared to speak about for the first few minutes is a more general set of observations about authorship and authority, but please don't take that as a lack of interest and wanting to engage specifically with anything you might want to say about SAGE or academic publishing in general. And what I will say bears on that too. But I do think that the background question, which for me is prompted by the nature of this conference and this round table, is, I think, intrinsically interesting. Because what strikes me when you look at the relationship between authorship and authority is that they are not equally linked to each other across different scholarly domains. I think a lot of when people are talking about forms of scholarly knowledge and scholarly communication, open access movements, there is a tendency to homogenize the scholarly communication system, whereas in fact I think it's highly varies sector by sector. And so while people talk about the fact there are 3 million articles being submitted to 30,000 peer-reviewed journals, that superficial similarity masks, I think, quite profound differences about what is an author. If you're submitting an article to a physics journal, that's not really your mechanism of gaining authority in your field. There are other mechanisms available, such as finding a job at CERN or the Large Hadron Collider, working in a multidisciplinary team, where the output of that might be, oh yes, we found the Higgs boson and an article appearing, but your concept of authorship relative to that article is very attenuated. By comparison with a social theorist wanting to make a further advance on Foucault's analysis of power. And I think it's very important to see that distinction when we think about what is an author in the future, because I think actually authorship is becoming almost a vanishing concept at the end of the scholarly communication system, where the primary metaphor is one of discovery. Find things and release them, as opposed to where the prime metaphor was one of interpretation, where you get the sense of the author much more vividly in place, which is more typical of the humanities and social sciences. And I think that's important, because if the route to authority, which I think everyone's trying to achieve in this sort of reputation economy, means climbing different kinds of ladders. And in the HSS world, there is still a need to have a reputation conferring mechanism, which is to do with acknowledging the quality of the authorship itself, which I think is very different from elsewhere. However, when you look at the homogenizing tendency to see scholarship all at once, or you've got a nice concrete example with the RCUK mandate to say, if you're going to publish open access, you should do it under a CC BY, the most permissive CC BY license. Why are the historians up in arms about it as compared with the medics? Well, I think they have a different relationship to the concept of authorship and whether their work can be remixed willy-nilly and so on. So that was sort of kind of one thing I wanted to mention. I obviously recognise that a lot of the current models for conferring authorship authority on authors are very flawed. There's a lot of there's a huge debate and controversy around the nature of peer review, the nature of replication, the nature of the publishing industry, the nature of accessibility to scholarship, the nature of the library market, and where funding moves around. They're all kind of highly problematic and problematized. But I think they have differential impacts because of this first distinction. Because the thing that holds up the discovery-led version of scholarship, let's say from medicine through to energy physics, is a larger political economic context, which is much, much bigger than any one industry, including academic publishing. It's huge. It's the National Institutes of Health is funded to the tune of $32 billion a year. The National Science Foundation, $7 billion a year. You're looking at enormous, and let alone sort of technology and other forms of industry, pharma industries and so on, who are supporting that end. In the social sciences, the broad underlying kind of economic sources are, apart from very small grants, so kind of in the sort of 10% and less range, there is the industry with library money pouring into it in one way or another. So if one is looking to tear up the current reputation conferring mechanisms, one needs to do it in a way that is sustainable. And I understand what you're saying, Christian, that that's code for profitable, but actually it does mean it needs to feed itself and repeat itself over time. Whoever's doing it, take publishers out of the equation, you still need sustainable reputation conferring mechanisms that enable the new authorial voices to find their feet. I think the last thing I just mentioned is that the kind of, you know, sort of the reputation economy, the political economy, there's also what the people are talking about as the attention economy. The sort of digital turn is creating a huge move toward, which I think is sort of reinforcing the idea that knowledge claims are a mode of discovery, and the emphasis therefore on sort of frictionless transmission of ideas, the idea of sort of more moving towards the commodification of information, I think is tilting the digital republic of letters away from authorship. It's now just about an unfettered access to information, which potentially obscures from view the conditions under which that content is produced in the first place. And I think that when you are in a mode that says we need highly efficient consumption, which is, you know, faster and freer and transparent and automated and suitable for aggregation, you're potentially damaging the reputation conferring mechanisms that that people in the more author end of the spectrum, humanities and social sciences, require. So I don't know whether a future model of a replacement for publishing enables the output of publishing that the output of ideas that we see now will be able to thrive or not. But I do think that reading across the models that seem to work in high energy physics and medicine into HSS is a failure to understand how granular and sector-specific solutions need to be. So I think if there's going to be some new way to create a mechanism for building a career in humanities and social science, I don't think that what works in the sort of highly funded and more discovery-orientated mechanisms are actually going to will do the job automatically. But I know that the main thing people want to talk about is publishing and Sage, and I will come to that when we get a chance. That's all I've got as an intro.
Great, thank you very much. Now going to hear from Stefan Böhm, who's the director of the Essex Sustainability Institute, and in 2000 he co-founded the journal Ephemera, and is currently editing the Open Publishing Press Mayfly Books.
Thank you, Jane. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for organising this panel on authority, authorship, and the future of academic publishing. I mean, the title of the panel is "What is an author now?" So, in a way, that's really, I see it as a kind of a production versus consumption model. So, authorship is about producing content. The flip side of that is, of course, that this is supposed to be consumed by someone. And earlier on, we heard from Mike Power about the impact agenda. So, you know, why are there authors? Why are we sitting here? Why are we producing stuff? Because we want, you know, stuff to be read. Hopefully, we want things to change out there in the world. We want to make something happen with the texts we produce. We want readers of the texts we produce. Right, the current publishing model fails to reach its consumers, its readers, on a large scale, on a humongous scale. Every, you know, almost on a daily basis, I'm getting emails from students, from colleagues, from members of the general public, saying, "I'm sorry, I can't access your article," or "I'm sorry, I can't access this or that journal. What do I do? I really like the abstract. I like the sound of it. You know, what do I do? I want to read this stuff." The current model is failing completely on that. I don't know the statistics. Maybe other people on this panel do know the statistics, but I imagine that, you know, 50, 60, 70% of the material that we produce and have produced is sitting behind corporate and other firewalls, meaning that you need to pay to get access to it. Either you pay online, you know, astonishing fees of $30-$40 or pounds a go sometimes, or your library has to pay for institutional access. Why only 50, 60, 70%? Well, because, of course, many people have realized that this is a ludicrous system. So we have something called the Green Open Access Movement, which basically encourages all authors to put their published stuff on repositories, openly accessible repositories. And that's legally possible. And many people, many authors do so, but I'm always astonished how many people don't do it. You know, I frequently go to, you know, colleagues' homepages and you know, there's no sense whatsoever that they have put their material on some sort of open access repository. Which is something we can do now. All of us can put our stuff out there quite legally, and that would solve the problem of the access issue. But for some reason, we don't. So the reader has a problem, can't access the stuff. The author has also a problem because the author is increasingly controlled, as we've heard, all sorts of metrics of publication intensity and extensity that government, universities, etc. are installing. The author is increasingly commodified, and there's a lot of free labor that we put into the system that doesn't actually produce the free access that we want. So the free labor is basically, you know, we're writing the articles or the books, and we to a very large extent, we're not getting paid for that labor. We're also reviewing for publishers for free. We are also editing journals. We are often proofreading. And increasingly we are being pushed to do the marketing of books and journal articles as well. So there's an awful lot that publishers used to do that is now being pushed down to the authors and editors of journals in particular, which, as Christian rightly said, has created a lot of shareholders are happy because a lot of these publishers are corporate, for-profit organizations, and we're largely talking about four or five global publishing conglomerates, one should call them. And there's been an industry concentration process going on, which we need to be aware of. You know, most of the journals, the area I know, humanities and social sciences, is kind of dominated by four or five global publishers now, and which have already been mentioned. And in a way, these publishers have so much power, since this is an event about Foucault to some extent, let's talk about power. So the power of these publishers is largely driven by them having, creating a lot of, they have bought up a lot of journals, a lot of content over the last 10, 20 years, right? And they keep on buying new journals and creating new journals. And they're kind of earning rent on the kind of empires they've built. And the move to the digital work has kind of increased that move of charging rent because, you know, a lot of access happens on an online basis now. You kind of have to go through the Taylor and Francis, the Springers, and the Elsewheres of the world to kind of get access. But also from an author point of view, what you have on the other side is the pressure from your university departments and from your bosses, as it were, to publish in certain journals, which are most, you know, often owned by these corporate publishers. So you have a kind of a push and pull factor, and the corporations are kind of sitting in the middle of these.
Your time is very nearly.
Okay. What I, you know, as was mentioned, you know, there are a lot of things we can do right now. I mentioned the Green Open Access movement, where you can just put stuff on the open access repositories. You can start your own journals. Throughout my career, I've co-founded three journals, stroke book publishers, called Ephemera, Interface, and Mayfly Books. These are all open access publishing platforms run by academics for academics. The technology allows us today to start a new journal ourselves, and it's quite easy. It involves labor, it's a lot of work, but given that we do a lot of this work for the publishers anyway, why don't we pool our resources and work together amongst academics to kind of make this labor work for the wider good of ourselves, of academia, as well as the wider world. So there's a lot of stuff we can do, and we don't need to be necessarily pessimistic and nostalgic about the good old days where everything was rosy. It's never been sort of rosy, but there's a lot of stuff we can do to improve the political economy of publishing, and a lot of people on this panel have been engaged in that movement, and in a way we're talking about a power struggle here about what is happening with our content, who produces it and how is it produced, and how can we get this content out there into the public without somebody kind of charging access fees or rent along the way. That's it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And last, we're going to hear from Paul Kirby, who is a lecturer in international studies at the University of Sussex. And he has a particular interest in the changing character of academia, and that has led to his work around open access.
Thanks very much. So what is an author now? One answer would be to say that academics write much as they always have, with an eye to a small circle of their imagined peers and an ear for what fora will promote them and their research to those peers. In this vision, the public figure is, at best, a distant consumer of some watered-down concepts and findings after the fact. Another answer would be to say that academics are publicly engaged as never before, quite apart from the extension of our reach through blogs, occasional bestsellers, and televised academic celebrity. We now also worry about the general availability of our precious peer-reviewed articles and whether we can gain traction for them through openness. We are pushed even further in these directions by the need to demonstrate that ever-elusive impact of our work. And these two answers reflect, I want to suggest, a familiar division. On the one hand, the academic as aloof, esoteric, a relic of sorts inhabiting a privileged cocoon, if now one that is more ivory bungalow than ivory tower. On the other hand, a view of the academic as relentlessly engaged, an intellectual activist, overconfident that their concepts can make a difference in the world, driven here by political conviction and there by economic or public health imperative. It is easy to see the second vision, that of the engaged author, as in harmony with the movement towards openness in publishing, open access, open metrics, open review, and more forms of openness besides. And the affinities, I think, are indeed strong. For those of us who see not just vague relevance in universities, but also truth, self-discovery, critique, and joy, locking articles behind paywalls is indeed perverse, since those walls, as we've heard, have been erected neither in our interests nor those of the reading public, and since they surely cost more in narrow financial terms than dismantling them would, it is easy to embrace open access in its most radical form. If we are to expand the academy, the practice that Aaron Beatty has so evocatively called socialized disagreement, then we must also retake control of its goods for ourselves and end their current function as an elaborate and obscene subsidy to corporate publishing houses. Now, there are no good arguments against openness in this sense, only conservative terror and a defense of naked economic self-interest. And yet, openness does not have just one sense. There is no singular open author. There is only openness in relation to some imagined audience or structure, and only access to something for some purpose. This much is obvious, but seldom acknowledged. Foucault and his interpreters have been overwhelmingly concerned with the production of subjects, especially in the absence of coercive or hierarchical power. And I think to adopt that analytic in this sphere means to interrogate openness as a political rationality. While open access in its most banal sense, being able to read stuff, is hardly to be feared, the general discourse of openness and the way in which it is increasingly framed in relation to academic labour is more deserving of our caution. For openness of content blurs easily with openness of evaluation. We have the negative freedom of open access, freeing up the journal system for the common reader, but also the associated measures of success that are parasitic on that openness. Right? Measures like how many times something has been downloaded, how many times it's been cited or readed, and who has done that citing and that reading. Now, these are forms of accounting, and as such are always already also techniques of government. And beyond the simple capacity to measure in this way, which is by no means restricted to arguments about open access, but goes with them surprisingly often in practice, there is also, or I think we could call, the injunction to be open, to share, to like, to circulate, to network, and so on. And when viewed in terms of the standards of academic life, I think this is also the injunction to accumulate citations and to build epistemic authority on the back of this quantification of relevance and of quality. So people may be aware that on Monday there's a hefty consultation closing on whether or not citations can be used as a measure of quality for research funding, and maybe we can talk about that as well. It is here, in the conflation of openness with an emergent apparatus for assessment and sorting, that I think we can see one strand of how the author is coming to be governed in academic life. And I think it's worth discussing how the language of openness is not just about expanding readership and expanding an audience, but is also tied up with these various arguments regarding metrics and sharing and impact. Now, three qualifications of that are in order. First, this is not a conspiratorial narrative in which the state seeks to discipline our work in any straightforward way, although there are clearly state and corporate agents who do have an interest in such areas. Instead, I think we need to locate the perils of openness and the discourse and political rationality of openness in a whole discursive social and economic shift that has taken place over the last decades and whose agents are probably more Google than Hefke. Second, many of these questions remain very open, both in terms of how they may develop, how openness may change, and also in terms of how they fit with other features of the system, features like the student consumer, the turn to austerity, and so on, that we discussed a little bit this morning. And finally, I think just like Foucault, we need to talk not just of governmentality, but also of resistance. Not our own heroic resistance per se, but the way in which a programmer's dream is frustrated or undone or fails to come into being. Both analytically and politically, I think this means tracing how certain spaces are defended from new technologies, but also how those technologies are inhabited in surprising ways and how they can be turned to other purposes by us.
Thank you. I think that shows quite what a number of things we could talk about in this session, but really we now want to hear from you. So are there any comments, questions that you would like to start us off with? Go on. And if you could just say your name and speak up so we can hear you, because we haven't got a microphone.
Okay, my name's Kiran Shandjolo. I don't have an institution technically due to the joys of precarity. My question was a comment, and it's a question as well. It's primarily inspired by Christian, but I think it relates to what everyone said on the panel. Communist publishing, Diamond, open access, I'm fully up for it. But how do we do it, right? There's this issue of parasitism that I think runs slightly deeper than just, say, governmentality or discipline, and actually sort of intrudes into the material well-being of academics. It's quite conceivable that people would use Diamond open access to write, publish, and access for free, but this could subsequently be used by researchers who then go and publish in for-profit enterprises. And so what you'd find, and you see quite a lot of this happening now, is that you get for-profit enterprises effectively subsuming and using all of this free labour, and thus lowering the value of labour power, increasing the rate of exploitation, etc. So how do we deal with this? The immediate answer is destroy SAGE, right? But I mean, what does this actually involve? What do we do? Do we not? what's the next step, right? So that's my question. How do we destroy SAGE?
You knew you were going, but anyway, we'll take a couple so it doesn't go.
There's
another one.
Yes, well, that relates. My name is Andreas Wittel, it's not a new trend. That relates directly to the comment that you have just made. The things that I kind of don't understand at the moment is that universities are very willing to pay huge amount of money to provide the gold open access. And I'm sort of thinking about what Christian said, the kind of, you know, the idea of kind of, you know, public funding of the Diamond One, that of course it involves labor, and Stefan talked about that, but I think the only kind of real labor that we would have to add to make that possible is the proofreading, because all the other stuff is kind of done anyway, the peer reviewing, the writing, the editing. So this is the only thing that's kind of missing. So if universities would spend the money that they sort of spend on the gold standard stuff for these kind of commercial conglomerates, it would actually become very easy to fund them. But there doesn't seem to be kind of any interest to move in this direction. I just wonder if so this is my comment, I kind of just wonder if you have any thoughts.
That's why, kind of UK, why Netherlands, other places are trying out different systems. Yeah. I mean, there's an argument why the UK is going for gold. It's because it does pay companies money, and the UK system is dominated by publishers who have the government's ear. So it's kind of UK and Netherlands that are pushing that particular system.
Universities are struggling. They want to save money. They could save money.
Yeah, it's okay. Trying to persuade them.
We'll just take one more for this round, and then we'll refer it back to the panel, and then I'll come to the other questions.
Just one kind of small aspect I was surprised not to hear anywhere. It's sort of been, I guess, one of the big revolutions in research funding of the last few years. The European Commission has just thrown 80 billion euros at research funding for the next 5 years, a program called Horizon 2020. And as part of that, well, one of the fundamental rules of this program is any research that gets published or that gets conducted funded by Horizon 2020 must be published in open access journals. Mm-hmm. Now, European level research funding makes RCUK look like pretty small fry. So, you know, based on that, I'm almost thinking, you know, almost no disrespect, but it was like, why are we having this discussion? Traditional publishing is dead. And in a bizarre twist of fate, actually, the
gold access. That's what we're having the discussion.
Sorry? Yeah.
We're having the discussion because the way that we're supposed to publish open access is already captured.
Yeah.
So we can't just publish anywhere on the web.
But in the UK, publish in plenty of, there's plenty of open access journals that aren't gold, about 60-70% of them aren't. Yeah. You were talking about publishing an open access journal that's not based in the UK. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. Not according to the ref.
So, the ref specifies it has to be a UK journal. I don't think so. The ref says you got published to an international standard. Yeah. So if you've got an American journal that's of a suitable standard, and they'll let you publish open access because the American and Obama government is pushing green open access.
And
The UK policy is dependent on the rest of the world following it with the gold open access, and it's not going to. So
finish your.
It's sort of a bizarre twist of fate, I suppose. Actually, their rationale for saying it has to be open access is, in a sense, due to the impact agenda. Because they're saying, well, we want research to be economically transformative. And the one thing I just kind of wanted to put to you and ask you, it kind of begs the question, okay, so how come there is still such a focus on traditional established journals? And I get the feeling that most of it actually has nothing to do with Hefke or these higher levels. But actually the institutions, when they monitor their stuff, they seem to generally use a pretty sloppy form of metrics where they actually, you know, genuinely say, okay, articles in high impact factor journals are measures of quality. Now, high-level research evaluators would never even make that assumption in the first place. But it's genuinely a question of sort of suspicion I have that that's basically what's keeping traditional journals alive. This sort of staff monitoring at the institutional level. I wonder if anyone knows anything about that, whether you could confirm or just confirm that.
Okay, we'll now get some responses. I mean, maybe we should start with you, Christian, because yeah. It was kind of, if I hadn't cut you off at your 7 minutes, how do we go about doing that? And then I think really we have to talk to Ziad about why he's going to have to
shut
down. Do something else. But then others, as you want to come in. So.
Yes, so like your question, how can we guarantee that if we have the open access journals that are non-profit and so on, that then for-profit publishers don't reuse the whole thing and again exploit free labor? I mean, it just depends on the licenses that we are using, and I mean, the ones who want to turn open access again into a business model, they promote the CC BY license, Creative Commons license, that allows reuse also for commercial purposes. So even people like the open access guru Peter Suber, they really like this license because it allows commercial reuse. I don't like this license because I don't want commercial publishers to reuse the knowledge published by non-profit projects. But I mean, the Creative Commons also has the non-commercial version, so it's a CC by NC license, which means non-commercial, which is the license also that the journal that I edit uses, which prohibits that it's reused for commercial purposes. There are also interesting new licenses. There is an idea by Dimitri Kleiner. He's a Berlin-based software engineer who wrote the Telecommunist Manifesto. He designed a license called the Peer Production License. If you use this license, then there can be reuse, but only for non-commercial purposes. Yeah? If you have a non-commercial organization, if it's commercial reuse, then those who want to commercially reuse it must pay some money to the open access projects. But I'm a little bit skeptical about this version. But it has to do with licenses. And what Andreas was saying, well, I completely agree with you, that there is a lot of money that is being used by universities. I mean, first, they pay money to the libraries, who then subscribe to journals, buy books, and so on. And now if the gold open access become and the APCs become more important, they take the same money and turn it into paying parts of these publishing fees for having their authors publishing in APC-based open access journals. But it's a kind of unnecessary middle that is always a company there, because this money could, I mean, which is partly student fees or basically debt coming from loans the students are making. Partly it's public funding, so it's taxpayers' money. Partly it comes from research funding and overheads, which is again taxpayers' money. And it's all being privatized, no matter in which of these versions. But it could be quite easy because the money is already there. You would just have to repurpose it so that the universities give money to those who are doing these non-profit publishing projects, or our libraries could turn into publishing houses, for example. Each university library could run a couple of open access journals. Also, they could employ a librarian, or people working in the library could become publishing workers. This would be, I mean, if it's a more or less public university system, then this could be new public service jobs within the academic system, which don't face these pressures that you have on the market. So there are potentials of doing it. The problem is just that there's a big lobby, a capitalist lobby that wants to turn open access again into a business model. And that's what I'm heavily opposing. And what Ziad was saying is also that it's about a reputation economy, and that sustainable publishing not just means sustainable profits, but also the sustainability of generating these reputations. But I don't see why we need a for-profit economy for generating reputation. I mean, generating reputation is done by things like Science Citations Index. Yeah? There is only a small minority of non-profit open access journals, or open access journals in general, in Science Citations in Index. It's not transparent how journals are selected. You can talk to people at EC Thompson, the librarians that they have who do the selection process. They will only tell you very basically, well, we do citation analysis. If you ask for, well, can you publish these citations analysis that you've done, they will not do it. It's not a transparent process, really. So I don't see how the model that I'm talking about can also produce reputation, but probably in general we should be skeptical about the rise of the instrumental logic that measures every output put that does citation analysis and so on. Yeah, I think I stop here.
I'd like to get Ziad to come in now as he's
okay.
A few things directed at him.
I will briefly step out of the toilet. So, what I was trying to get at by saying scholarship is not homogenous was a way of saying what are problems now but don't apply equally to different fields. So Einstein and Foucault are not both authors in the same way. When Einstein wrote about energy, he could have nailed it. Mass times speed of light squared. It was in an article published in 1905. No one needs to read that article now. And you could argue Einstein doesn't need a journal brand even. I don't know, you could argue, because nowadays he'd be working on in a major multidisciplinary project with a ton of government money or private money going into it. Foucault was publishing a bunch of books which built a reputation which became sustained over time and has triggered a conference to honour, remember him 30 years after his death. They are not the same thing, and I'm amazed by how often we talk about scholarly communication as though scholarship is one homogenous thing. And I emphasise that because I think the solutions that are going to work in the future for these different domains are not the same either. So a gold open access model is working already and has done for a long time in medical fields. It works incredibly well. The biggest journal in the world is PLOS ONE. It had over 35,000 articles published through it last year with an average APC of $1,350. It is a massive multi-million dollar enterprise because medicine is massively funded in a certain kind of a way. For the same reason, Wellcome can launch, alongside the Howard Hughes Institute and the Max Planck Institute, can launch eLife with no APCs because Wellcome says, we're happy to donate $3,000 of any research grant to support the publishing output. And so what's true of physicists and what's true of medics and what's true of historians and what's true of social theorists are not the same thing. And so why can't we get sector-specific in trying to work out what is a problem and what isn't a problem? So that's one thing. Now getting onto the publishing industry, I would also argue that publishing is not homogenous either. There are about 2,000 publishers, ranging from the Elsevier et al., through to learned societies, to very small independents, and in between a whole host of university presses, some of whom are only publishing books, some of whom are publishing all sorts of things. The publishing industry is a complicated and different and very variable thing. It's for each of you to look at Sage and say, are we like Elsevier? Are we like Wiley Blackwell? Are we like OUP? Are we like CUP? Are we like the British Psychological Society? But I don't think it makes sense to look at the academic publishing industry as a homogenous block either. So scholarship isn't homogenous and academic publishing isn't homogenous. And so to talk about Sage then specifically, the journals that we publish broadly fall into the classes of either we publish them on behalf of societies, we publish on behalf of about 300 societies, and the vast bulk of those societies get very, very high royalties. So yes, we take that money out of the library market and hand it to the learned societies, who then do the thing that they do. And it's very low margin business for us. That's just how society journal publishing has ended up. It's highly competitive for publishers. It's beneficial to us because it adds luster and prestige, but it's relatively low margin, sometimes no margin. But the societies are doing their work. So one question you might want to ask is, what is the role of the learned society, and to what extent does it need its funding? Because in fields like chemistry and physics, you could argue it doesn't need, you don't need them organizing themselves in that way, but maybe in sociology you do, and I'd leave that for people to assess. But the other thing that we do, and here I want to suppose make the argument that instead of parasitism, I see symbiosis. I would argue that our role is symbiotic. So when I was a psychology editor, I was tasked with focusing on the journal's publishing program and launched a whole range of journals. A lot of the journals I was involved in launching were at the critical and theoretical end of psychology. It was an attempt to try and, from our point of view, rebalance a lot of the way the literature and the discipline seem to be arranged, with a fair degree of commercial risk attached to it. So whether it was theory of psychology, feminism psychology, discourse and society, culture and psychology, and a whole slew of such titles going across from anthropology to social theory, from philosophy to social criticism to you name it, we took a bunch of commercial bets which were very long-term in their own right, each of which have now created a community of scholars around them who now have a disciplinary focus which arguably they would not previously have had. If those have become profitable for us because there are lots of features of the library market which are frankly quite dysfunctional, that is an unfortunate reality, or fortunate if you're on the right side of it. So Sage has a lot of profits that come from the fact that libraries subscribe to things that they would arguably cancel if they felt free to, but there's a whole set of inertial settings that make it harder for them to move freely in that way. If they were to move more freely, we feel we would have more opportunities to launch new journals and watch some of our own journals die, but maybe make quick some new journals and have a more of a supply and demand relationship, and therefore be more sort of creative than we can be. But the most successful journals are basically ones that were launched a very long time ago, long before Sage was founded. And then the other thing I would say, just maybe just to kind of not go on too long, is that obviously we're trying to experiment with open models, and we're trying to push as much towards the green end of the spectrum as possible in terms of enabling authors to put the kind of final accepted version of their articles in the repository so they have a good answer to Stefan's question, I can't get it, what can I do? Well, go to the author's website or email the author, and we could try and ameliorate some of the issues, which I agree must be incredibly frustrating when confronted by paywalls. I suppose the question I'd leave everyone with is all this that people are saying about the nature of scholarly publishing equally applicable to book publishing? So going back to, it's not a homogenous thing. Is it all equally the case? And specifically, I'd love to know, Christian, why it was that you chose to publish your book with Sage in December, which is, I'm glad to say, doing very well, but I'd love to know what it was that motivated you to do that, because I know you can cook your own food.
Okay, but before you come back on that, I know Gary wants to come in, and then if you want to come in, and then Christian can answer.
Okay, I mean, just to answer your question, you know, why can't we have a more pluralistic model where, you know, mm-hmm. 1,000 flowers can bloom and all this kind of thing? It's politics. It's what your politics are. And, you know, this liberal version, and we're going to have all these things. Liberalism is still a political position. Mm-hmm. So we can illustrate this. I mean, kind of what you were talking about, different notions of authorship. Yeah, that's in Foucault. That's in his piece on what is an author. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the reason why we're talking about Foucault is because of power. And so the way that the publishing industry works, it privileges certain forms of publishing, dissemination, production, yeah. In particular in certain places. So English language, so, you know, the UK, America, Australia, French language, you know, the big colonial languages. Mm-hmm. Those are the big... We're talking about French theorists, and, you know, where are the big theory movements? They're in France, a bit in America, Italy's probably had its like peak. Just had peak beard, we've had kind of peak Italian now. But you're not getting them from other places. We're not... discussing theorists from other places, you know, outside the North, outside the West, and it's because of certain, you know, the way that power works, the way that politics works. So just saying, hey, we can have all these different versions.
I'm not saying free-for-all, I'm saying look at it domain-specifically. What do you need to get more Einsteins, and what do you need to get more Foucaults? They're not the same thing, that's all I'm trying to say.
Can we go back to one or two questions that were actually asked? So one of the questions was, well, that's your question to Christian as well, why do we still publish with certain journals or with certain publishers? And, well, the answer is clear, because, yes, they are institutions that tell you where to publish and where not to publish.
You mean the higher ed institutions are telling you where to publish, presumably?
Yeah, well, yeah. So I work in a business school. The business school has a very, very shoddily put together, very problematic list.
Of acceptable outlets.
Of acceptable journal outlets.
Required, and, not acceptable.
Yeah, but like a necessary, you don't exist unless you...
Book publishing is not even seen as acceptable. You're not... you're allowed to publish a book, but you know you're not getting any.
It is in history and philosophy. That's what I'm trying to say.
Of course. But you know, in the business school arena, you're not really supposed to do any book publishing. It's just journals, and there's a so-called ABS list, the Association of Business School Journal Metrics list, that basically has, you know, a list of journals that are seen as good. And that's it. And that's probably 5% of the possible journals that you could publish in. So, you know, you can't just publish in an open access American journal because you wouldn't get any bounty pounds for it. And I'm sure in your...
But open access,
it goes back really to reputational questions. So how, you know, how's the reputational economy work? I mean, it's through politics, it's through history, it's through power struggles. Traditional journal publishing is still the main still attractive from lots of people, although there are all these alternatives because of vested interests in that are bundled in certain journals, and one can't just set up an alternative journal and then overnight see everyone publishing that alternative journal. Doesn't work that way.
Can I make a counter-argument to that? So, okay, so one of the things I'm known for is publishing Open Humanities Press, and what we started off with was a collection of journals, because open access journals precisely have this problem. So when we started, we got a meta-refereeing board to kind of judge the journals and sort of say these are okay. So we had Spivak and Badiou and Latour and all of these people, and they're all on the board, and they judge our journals. And if a new journal wants to join, they have to kind of go through this process. And so when in Australia, they did try and rank some of our journals that are based in Australia, and one of them got judged a C category, and A is the highest, and then they kind of, there's always an appeals process, and they went through it and they said, look, who's on this editorial board, and they got bumped up to an A. So you can do it, but you've got to work strategically. It could be that this could also be a way that Impact would work with us, because you can say, well, this journal might be closed and it might be high, but I'm not going to get any Impact, I'm not going to get anyone reading it. You can kind of play the game a little bit. So that you're right in that sense, that there isn't one rule hard and fast that's going to apply, but you have to play the game strategically. But I'd want to talk about, we have to act a bit differently as well. You have to take different things in terms of, you might have to do a bit more work in terms of copy editing, or not just, you know, hand everything over to the publisher and expect them to be able to do it. I publish open access books as well, and you wouldn't believe how people, they want everything that comes with open access, and yet they want you to act completely like a traditional publisher. And it's going to change, we're going to have to change a little bit as well if you want more of this system. It can't be just, you're going to get these guys that are going to come and take this problem away for you, so you can just carry on the same. You're going to have to change a little bit if you want it.
Right, we're just going to hear from Paul, and then we're going to come back to the next round of questions.
Yeah, great. A few things to say. I think it is true that a lot of the pressure to publish specific journals is coming from a local level and it's not coming from Hefty, or is part of an elaborate second-guessing, right? The ref says the outlet doesn't matter. Everybody kind of knows that if you look at the number of articles that the panelists have to review, they can't actually plausibly read the articles properly. You kind of know that they're going to second guess. So even though they say we don't take the journal time to account, everyone assumes they do and so on, right? So yes, there are some local dynamics there which are important for explaining it. So to the question about how you shift the system, what Christian said at the beginning about just transferring the labour in-house is all true, but it's a very, very big collective action problem, one. And second, you've got really big questions around how the transition phase will work. If LSE Library decides that it's going to take everything in-house, it's less to pay the subscriptions to all the existing journals, right? There's no way that it can't provide that and just say, oh, well, we will somehow take the totality of social science knowledge in-house and just do it ourselves. It's impossible. You would need to have proper collaboration between all of the research universities, or else you wouldn't get the decrease in costs, right? So in the short term, you'd be talking about increasing costs in taking stuff in-house unless you're coordinated properly, and that raises a lot of problems. One of the responses people have to that is to really emphasize this voluntary model. Right? And there are lots of good and interesting stuff that's out there and that's being published that is largely led by people setting it up and doing it in their free time and doing it for no money. I do not think this is something that we should be celebrating or encouraging. People want to do it, that's fine, but editing work is labor and deserves to be compensated as labor. And anybody who thinks that you can replicate the existing social science or natural science journal ecosystem on the basis of voluntary labor, I think is very, very naive. Right, so we need to talk about how to put those roles in ways that can be paid, which I do think means taking them in-house, but it's a very, very big task. It's not a question of just go and set up a new journal and everything will be hunky-dory. I mean, it might be fine for you, but it's not going to shift the whole journal publishing ecosystem, and it's not going to shift the reputational economy. And there are all those problems that arise around precarious labor and asking people to do even more for less that go with that. Whereas what we should be saying is that we can get more out of the system and pay people better and charge libraries less. Right? That's the direction to go in. One final thing, partly in defense of journals. There's also an argument that goes, publish the material wherever, just upload the documents on the internet, and people will find stuff that is good quality. Right? So you don't need journals at all. I think this is, again, kind of naive in terms of the quantity of information there is out there. And I think we need to have a mature conversation about the curation function of journals and of editing, right? That it's not just a question of information froze freely in some unbounded way. There is a role for journals, especially in social sciences, which guard and protect certain kinds of analysis and celebrate and allow that to occur in a way that it just won't be found and it won't have the same kind of resonance if it's just somebody's uploaded a Word document, academia.edu, right? So that doesn't mean that the journals have to be done by for-profits by any means, right? I think that can happen very happily with in-house university-based presses. But I think there is a role for the preservation of the journal as a kind of collective entity and as a collection of documents.
Thank you. Okay, so next round of questions. We've got one, okay. All right, well, we'll take these two and then see if anyone else has got a thought.
Thanks. So, Milena Kromakova, Warwick University Institute for Water Research. I wanted to come back to Paul's very good point about the parasitic relationship between assessment of academics' work and the need to publish, because I think it lies at the heart of the problem. Because we do need to publish, because we do work and we want others to read it, but then we're, of course, judged by how good the work is by some metrics that are defined in some not very perfect ways about whether work is good. And this reminded me of an article, an interview I read with Peter Higgs, who discovered the Higgs boson in December 2013, and he said, I would never have done any of these discoveries if I had this question to publish. And even though, of course, things are different in physics compared to the social sciences and history and so on, I think this point is the same everywhere, because the relationship between publishing and research and motivation to do research is completely reversed in this case. It's not the journal's fault. Journals are just, and publishing houses, they're jumping on the bandwagon because the system of research and higher education is standing on its head. So that's a very basic problem that we all somehow need to address and discuss before we even get to the practicalities about which open access is better, and so on. And a second point about, I also wonder, why don't sociologists, for example, want to publish their stuff online? I think part of the problem is that we're not so technologically savvy as our colleagues in maths. I think that's maybe a small reason, but it's definitely that many of my colleagues, including myself, we don't really understand the legal implications and don't really know which of the open access licenses to choose, and it's so much hassle. We prefer to do whatever our department tells us and choose one of those 10 journals or 20 journals. It's just easier.
Okay.
Can I say, have you done any research on, I mean, since we're all kind of researchers and we can learn these things, have you?
So we need to become journalists to know about journals.
It's not that hard. It'll take you a couple of hours. It's really not that hard.
Yeah, I know, but the reason, the problem is that people are not willing to publish their stuff online, preprints online. Why?
And I think it is harder than you give credit for. There are people on this panel who are misusing the word gold, right? Who were saying that gold means ABC. Gold does not mean ABC. Gold does not mean that you charge for access, right? So even the technical definitions, I think there are some barriers that we shouldn't understate.
Okay. We'll just take this one and then we'll come back and we'll start with Paul this time around. So,
thank you. My name is Emma Dowling with the Flex University. I just have a couple of points to make on this issue, in fact, of sharing information. It would be really helpful, actually, for those who do know about these things to put out information, you know, frequently asked questions and sort of fact guides of what to do and how to publish and how to do these things if we are interested in a more autonomous, self-organised way of publishing and sharing information. And I guess that really also relates to this question of what do we publish for? We publish for our work to be read, we publish to communicate and to share information and learning. And if we have these very entrenched notions of expertise and authorship that limit that ability to study to a certain group of people that already has a privileged position, then perhaps we're not doing ourselves any favours either. I mean, many feminists have asked the question for a long time of what constitutes knowledge and who gets to speak and who gets to produce that knowledge, whose knowledge counts and whose knowledge doesn't count. And actually asking the question of whose knowledge counts and whose knowledge doesn't count is intimately connected, of course, with how publishing is organised. So actually that is something that we also have to really think about. Provocatively, maybe we need to get rid of Einstein, right? And this notion of Einstein, if we're going to get anywhere more progressive. And just the other point I wanted to make also about this question of why don't we just have the proofing, we do the proofing ourselves, we do everything ourselves, and the university could pay for that to be done. It's, I think, an important point that Wendy mentioned in her talk earlier, namely the bigger picture of the shareholder value, right? And that management decisions are being made on the basis of the need for quantification in order to appear in the league tables and the rankings and the this, that, or the other, such that there is this compulsion to reproduce this model in all areas, such that one is still economically viable in this world of shareholder value. So that's why you can't just have the proofing done in-house, because it wouldn't fit in. I mean, I know you probably know this. I'm not, to that extent, we're preaching to the converted when we have these conversations. But how do we then tackle this issue of the shareholder value and the return on investment that is dominating, that is governing the way that we do things?
Great, okay. So, yeah, let's start at that end this time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a nice opportunity to do a plug. Late last year, I wrote a full-page guide to open access in social sciences for Spark Europe, which if you Google my name and go to my Sussex page, there's a link there, and that's all available, which covers terminology and also some of the challenges. So there's stuff out there, but I completely agree that it's not always as easy to access as it might be, which kind of goes to one of the implicit questions here, which is about who has the responsibility to move the system. Of course it's true that in an age of academia.edu and in an age where Hefke and others are going to mandate repository-based versions of our articles for the next RAF and so on, that people should be doing basics in terms of uploading draft versions and so on. Nevertheless, I think it's problematic when the assumption is that it's up to early career researchers and precarious academic labourers to publish in certain kinds of outlets that might make it more difficult for them to get probation, might make it more difficult for them to get tenure, which aren't very well understood, which if the new ventures might have folded in 5 years' time if they've run heavily on voluntary labour. And I think that kind of, oh, well, you're the next generation, you handle the world that's changing, which comes, you know, from some quarters, really needs to be resisted. And instead, what we need to be talking about in relation to Karem's earlier question about shifting the system and how to do that is to be really saying to the professors and high-level people who edit the major journals in our fields, why are you still contributing to this kind of closed system? Right? There are issues there because some of the journal titles are technically owned by companies, so you can't just wait until your contract is up and then do that journal open access, right? Because, say, just bring whoever owned the title. But there have been cases of editorial boards resigning en masse and then setting up basically the same journal content-wise the next day under a slightly different title and so on. And professors and people in high-ranked universities are going to have much better access to the kinds of funds and the kinds of institutional support that would enable them to do that without having to rely on free junior labor, right? So I think it's our responsibility to push those people and to push those editorial boards, and also not to get seduced when we get asked to be on an editorial board for a fancy a journal within our discipline for nothing, or to review even for those journals. Just, you know, we have to get good at turning them down and saying, well, not until you have a better model in terms of access. Right, so I think that's the direction the change needs to come from, rather than, you know, junior and early career scholars transforming the system in the next 15 years.
And did you want to, because you mentioned metrics earlier, there was a point about assessment, is this sort of evaluation and assessment driving this?
I don't think it's driving the move to openness as a whole. I think openness has an availability to capture, you know, as we've discussed with the APCs, that movements that might have originally been quite liberatory and emancipatory in terms of their aims, you know, once they start getting taken seriously, then it can very easily become, oh yes, you can have openness, but at a certain cost, and that cost is APCs. Or we want to make openness in terms of reading basically synonymous with altmetrics and with this question of, can we just bypass judgment by saying the department that has the most accumulated citations in a five-year period will get the most research center funding, right? Which is gameable in all kinds of ways. And final plug, we have a letter to the Hefty consultation, which is up on the blog, thedisorderofthings.com, if people want to have a look at that and see what some of the objections are to the Hefty approach, or the Hefty consultation, I should say, because I haven't suggested a particular view on what metrics do and how metrics can be used to judge the quality of research.
Thank you. Does anyone else want to dive in?
Can I just throw something else into the ring? We've got now an example where the power of corporate publishers has kind of gone into a slightly different direction. It's not just about access and profits, etc. We now have an example of Taylor and Francis actively censoring a publication, an academic publication. So some of you are nodding your head, so you might have heard about this. So there's this journal called Prometheus, which is publishing critical work on innovation. So it's coming out of innovation studies. And they published a special section of a journal issue on these kind of debates. And there was one paper by four Leicester colleagues, which was very, very critical of the publishing industry and literally named and shamed some publishers and their high levels of profiteering, etc., etc. And Taylor and Francis refused to publish that piece, and the piece had to basically was censored, and publisher names had to be taken out, the whole thing had to be made anonymous, and certain other passages were censored. So I think that adds, yeah, a slightly different side to this whole story. So it's not just about open access and you know, do we get stuff to read and who pays for it, etc. But you know, it seems that some of the publishers are getting so powerful now that they think they can shut down academic debates, right? And if we kind of enter that sort of arena, then well, it becomes a much more interesting and dangerous debate and dangerous ground to stand on. And well, the whole thing becomes more urgent for us to address, because if we basically lose our freedom to publish content and to be creative and to critique and to do stuff what we want to do, if we can't do that within the current system, then we have a much, much bigger problem than the whole Admaxis debate.
Yes, I wanted to say that, I mean, it's a question of power relationships also between the non-commercial projects that are already there and the for-profit publishers, because on the one hand, as Stefan was also saying, it's about the reputation economy that is mainly controlled by the for-profit publishers, and on the other hand, also the monetary resources that need to go into copy editing and proofreading and so on. Now, that's easier in the case of open access journals to organize it without money or not so much money. Yeah, so in my case, of my open access journal, for like 10 years we had no budget at all. Now I convinced my university that they pay for 10 hours a week for a copy editor, which helps us somehow. But with book publishing it's more difficult, because maybe 10 or 20 articles make one book. So if you have an open access book publishing house, and you and I think also these open access book publishing houses, they have a right to also have people working there and being paid for it. But this does not work yet. But you're right that I've published all sorts of books, one with Sage that you were mentioning, Routledge, several books, Palgrave, Macmillan, and I like none of these models. There are problems everywhere involved. And you know, like in book publishing, publishing houses distinguish between a monograph and the textbook. So a textbook is something you sell to undergraduate students. These are those who are expected to buy them. You can get an immediate paperback for it, because publishers think students will buy it. Then the more difficult books, they are monographs. The publishing houses think, well, who will buy it? Libraries will buy it. So they put out a £100 hardback, and then the paperback will follow maybe in 1 year, maybe never. Yeah, it depends on the publisher. It depends on how well you are known. And I have experienced that with all of these models, and there are always problems in involved. So, for example, this is my Sage book. It's an introductory book. I did not want to write it as an introductory book, really, but I had to water it down somehow in terms of making it really student-friendly, yeah, so that it's really an introductory book, because then it might sell. But still, I get, I think, 5% of the revenues. Sage gets 95% of it. But one can, it's an immediate paperback. Most of the books I have been doing were like...
Why?
Huh?
Why?
Why I'm publishing?
Yeah.
Because still, you cannot exit this reputation economy
even for
tomorrow.
Textbooks. Do textbooks confer reputation in the same way?
Yes.
Okay. And typically find that that's less.
But I would
less of a joy.
I would prefer to do it with an open access book publisher. But I would like to be able to pay someone for the copy editing and for the proofreading. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the money for paying someone for doing it.
You
I don't
pay us.
I would not want to do it. But I want to pay someone for doing it. But I don't have the money. And like if a research funding agency, some funding agency will not give me money for writing a book about Marx for doing the copy editing.
And what you got?
But what I'm saying is there should then.
what you got in your pockets?
Well, nothing. But I think there should be payment, and that's why it's a political issue that we demand public support for open access book publishers. So it's a two-front struggle that we cannot exit this system tomorrow, but that we must do everything that publishing houses like yours don't depend on just people layouting the stuff themselves. So they have the right that they get some material support.
I get a
support.
Wage from my institution. Part of my wage institution is to do research. Part of that time that I get to do research, I devote to publishing people such as this yourself.
Right.
Give me the pencil case.
there are other things. But it would be nicer if there would be,
it would be, but
a
we're
funding agency giving us the money for it.
So that comes to the fundamental question. Is there the public appetite to drive sort of public solutions to solve the problem that you're identifying? And it goes back to the whose knowledge counts question. What I perceive is a skewing away from HSS and towards. So if you're going to let the public decide, I think you will have towards the knowledge that's demonstrably utility orientated, the stuff that can cure cancer or create widgets
You keep talking about us having a diverse model, but a lot of the model that you keep pushing is a very science model. It's kind of very, you're going to say, well, look, I see that everyone's moving over to science. I'm just wondering how much that's actually the true, and that's how much that's your interpretation.
One of the things I have with open access is
science models imposed on them.
So in the US, the National Science Foundation has an annual budget of $7.2 billion. The social behavioral economics bit of it is $250
million.
And there is a bill going through, going to be in front of Congress to try and reduce that by 100 million. There have been several onslaughts over the last few years to try and say this is a waste of taxpayers' dollars. It does not cure cancer. You're wasting your money spending it on this social behavioural stuff. Let's please switch it over to this other stuff. So
we're struggling against it rather than saying this is the way it kind of is.
Well, we're actually struggling against it as an entity, and I think in terms of assessing whether we're parasitical or symbiotic, I think. If you take Sage out of it, if you take philosophy publishers out of philosophy, do you think philosophy would be better served? I think you can take them out of high energy physics and out of medicine, but I suspect it's variable in terms of their impact domain by domain.
But surely, I mean, the point is you can't take the publishers out of this, right? I mean, the point is, more than anything else, is the more that you do publish in this vein, the more that assumption becomes normalized, right? The more that actually we just assume that the only worthy outputs are the ones that are policy driven and instrumentalized.
Well,
isn't that the point about this conference, right?
So that's, I think there's a whole reputation economy that's being driven by institutions of various kinds, but basically the higher education sector. And I'm just wondering whether you could argue certain strands of work are actually being enabled to preserve and protected despite those traditions because of various enterprising publishers. And I'm happy to exclude Sage from that analysis, but pick some small university press who's ploughing away, knocking out books that would otherwise not see the light of day or take their place in the Republic of Letters. And I think there is a skewing away. Back to the point about who knows the technology and so on, that if you look at the debate between Steven Pinker and Leon Wieselter on the New Republic about humanities need to learn from science, everything that Steven Pinker writes is then blogged and reblogged by Dan Dennett and Evolution is True and Jerry Coyne and so on. The humanities side of the argument is this echoing silence with tumbleweed running through it. There's just a complete skew in terms of what's shaping and influencing public debate. If you look at entries on Wikipedia,
we don't want to act as those kind of neoliberal subjects. We've got to act as an entrepreneur for yourself, get out there on Twitter. I mean, I know some people on Twitter and things, or Facebook. Maybe we just don't want to do that. Maybe that's the reason for it. It seems to you is the silence. Maybe we're doing something else.
Yeah, I'm
so sorry, but we're already 5 minutes over time, and I know the rest of the thing. I think we could talk about this for lots, lots longer. But thank you very much, and if you join me in thanking.